We're on.
Oh, everything's
recording.
Everything
we
stops.
Can't communicate. We're on. So we're in Building 10.
Yes, we are
talking to technical architect Tara. I don't want to Tara. You know, just Prakriya. All right.
There she is.
And so, what do you do?
Well, I work in the Unlimited Potential Group, and what we do here in the Unlimited Potential Group is figure out new solutions for consumers, primarily in the middle and bottom of the economic pyramid.
Okay.
So Microsoft historically has worked on products that are for the top of the pyramid, as we like to think of it.
Yeah.
Of course, includes consumer as well as enterprise solutions. Mm-hmm. But we think there's a big opportunity if we go below that surface to that middle and bottom.
Okay. So you did basically the what is it? It's the ultra mobile PC, but the memory is not hard disk, and it's still affordable.
Right, so actually our team did do that. So we do work on what we call ultra-low-cost PCs, which is the kind of companion piece, if you will, to the ultra-mobile PC, which I also have worked on. What we've found, the emerging market space is actually pretty interesting. And when you're designing solutions for middle and bottom of the pyramid, this is my point of view, but I think there are kind of three major reasons to bother or to, why this is important for Microsoft to go after. The first is it's a fantastic revenue opportunity. These are, just historically, since the dawn of time, these are folks who've got more discretionary spending money than ever they have in the history of the world. And if you can create the right value proposition, there's a tremendous market opportunity for Microsoft to grow beyond what our traditional markets have been. So that's, I'd say, first and foremost, a really exciting opportunity to connect with a whole new class of customer that we just haven't had the opportunity to think about before. But the second reason to worry about this is, the channel problem. If we can figure out how to get to these customers in some way, because now we've got to have new ways of reaching them, new business models, new channels, new support models, a whole bunch of things that we almost take for granted in today's PC ecosystem, then we can not only sell them new value propositions, but potentially all the other things that we have now a route to that same customer as well. Mm-hmm. And the third reason is what you bring up with, kind of the distinction between an ultra low cost PC and an ultra mobile PC. Mm-hmm. Technically, they're actually pretty darn similar. What's interesting about designing, though, for the constraints of the emerging market, and constraints includes things like you can expect internet connectivity, but it's probably intermittent internet connectivity, especially for broadband. Mm. You have constraints like cost, or at least you have to design your products that can be consumable in smaller chunks. Mm. You probably don't have as much maintenance available in the field, or stores you can go to for getting your retail support and the rest of that stuff. So you've got to design in such a way that it has to be as low touch as possible, mm-hmm. and so it really has to just design for the task. But interestingly, if you do all those things, you might have a great product that's really relevant to developed markets as well. And so what we found with the ultra-low-cost PCs is that while Nicholas Negroponte kind of did start a huge trend in the industry in looking at things like the one laptop or child PC, et cetera, that were initially really focused at emerging markets and kids specifically in emerging markets, companies then like Asus with the EEE have kind of taken that as a technology platform, and now it's actually available for consumers worldwide. And as a result, it's one of the projects that we have what we will call graduated from the emerging markets group really, to Windows COSD, because it's a broad market phenomenon at this point and has a ton in common with the UMPCs that we had been working on.
Interesting. Hmm. Yeah, I thought the ultra-low-cost PCs are really interesting because the team basically took Windows XP, modified the kernel, because there were kernel changes that had to be made, and some other things. And then they got it to run in really low constrained memory context. And that's really interesting for the future of mobility, for example.
Well, it's there is a lot that we can talk about just that one topic alone. certainly, it's a controversial and a pretty sore topic because the way we're able to implement some fantastic things to work for XP Windows, for example, to get to work on a one laptop or a child machine, which is an incredibly constrained device. It's constrained for memory. It's constrained for in performance, it's just constrained all over the place. And the team leveraged the SD slot to be able to expand the flash memory and a whole bunch. It's truly innovative and really, really great stuff. But the challenge is then going to be for Windows, obviously Vista, but then Windows 7, Windows 8, the rest of that line. Mm-hmm. What is our story really going to be for these constrained computers? Mm-hmm. And especially as we start to think about that blurry line between phones and PCs, you know, what are we really going to do for that? Mm-hmm. It almost, you know, begs the question, do we have to take a drastic change in our operating system architecture where we kind of design small and then expand big, mm-hmm. Or continue to, you know, think about an all-purpose desktop solution that also works on this class of machines? But there are some interesting opportunities for leveraging, you know, virtualization and other technologies to potentially, you know, maybe change how we slice this problem altogether. That maybe there's a MinWin that runs on a smaller class of machines, and then you could count on having some sort of server connectivity, either local server or internet server, and you know, distribute the workload, if you will. Because the key is, you know, full app compat. You know, shrinking down is the easy part, but shrinking down and keeping the entire Windows ecosystem, that's the challenge.
Agreed.
I don't know that there is an easy answer for this one.
It's true.
Wow.
It's absolutely true. So what exactly do you do? I mean, what's a technical architect?
A technical architect, what a funny title. I guess I consider myself an architect, but I don't know about specifically technical or not. You know, I'm in the business of finding solutions to problems, to hard problems that I have. Hard in the sense that they're complicated by both business model as well as by, you know, new domains, and then trying to figure out what a technical solution could even possibly look like, or if it's even feasible, mm-hmm. Within the envelopes that the market, you know, has designed for it. Mm. It also means, you know, being an architect, essentially, you're also not necessarily the decision maker. You're an influencer to a large extent. So it's understanding, you know, the edges on which you're making those, you're making those recommendations that, you know, there's all this stuff and it's fairly complicated and there's no right answer because there never really is. But if you go down this road, it's going to lead to these 20,000 implications either for a technical roadmap going forward or for what your business opportunity is going to be. Mm. Or if you go down this way, it's going to lead to that and then, you know, seeing what that's going to look like. So I've been specializing, if you will, on some of our education opportunities in emerging markets, knowing that from a value proposition perspective, it's the thing that, you know, rises way to the top as far as what people are willing to spend, you know, spend consumer money on. Every culture in the world cares about their kids' education, and emerging markets is absolutely no exception to that particular rule. If not, it's even more emphasized in those areas. So we have some pretty interesting consumer products that we've been working on there, as well as, you know, kind of traditional K-12 type products. And so when we looked at one laptop per child, for example, one of, you know, Microsoft's challenges has been, well, what's our response to that going to be? So certainly, you know, we made sure that Windows could work on such a machine, and that's an important part of the response. We also work very closely with Intel and other, you know, laptop manufacturers who are going after these markets to make sure that Windows and Windows software, all of it, not just not just Windows, but also Office and, you know, the rest of the education products and our ISVs can all be available on there. But we also wanted to think about how are we really going to win in this space? So one of the projects that I worked on was trying to figure out how to design what that full compete story was going to look like. And we came up with actually something that is much more about the server in a school than it is about that specific client device. What we realized is that when, you know, analyzing the problem space, we all win if, you know, laptops per children become, you know, highly successful. But realistically, when you're looking at schools, especially poor schools, but even rich schools for that matter, it's not necessarily feasible to really design solutions where every single kid is going to get a homogeneous, exactly the same spec laptop and, you know, and then have solutions for that. So by moving the focus really to the server that could be in a school, you could support a heterogeneous client architecture where maybe, you know, some kids have a mouse, maybe there's actually a classroom where the teacher's only projecting, and so the kids actually don't have a specific technological device of their own. Mm-hmm. There are PDAs and laptops, but also secondary PCs, because reefer machines are a reality in emerging markets, and these are also low-spec devices, much like these low-cost computers. And these are machines where, you know, Office 14 may not run. And so the other thing we want to be able to make sure is that if we're looking at a server strategy is if we can actually change the paradigm to some extent to be more of a terminal services type approach so that it may not be the client that's doing all the computing, but maybe the application is actually just getting served off the server. Mm-hmm. Now we can help that ecosystem flourish because they got an actual spec to target. And still support that, you know, kind of heterogeneous ecosystem.
So it's essentially a mobile thin client.
In some ways. Now, mobile is kind of funny. When we analyzed, you know, what the attributes of these schools were, mm-hmm. We looked at a couple of different attributes. So the first one was, you know, school enrollments worldwide. You know, where are the kids? You know, what do we have to think about when we're thinking about this problem? Let's just kind of look at it, you know, all up. So we looked at it from primary school, secondary school, higher education, you know, middle of the pyramid, bottom of the pyramid, and top of the pyramid. And within no time at all, you realize, wow, there are a lot of kids worldwide in that kind of bottom left segment, which is primary school with and very, very poor. And there are, of course, there are opportunities for in top and higher ed. But if you're going to, you know, solve solutions here, you kind of have to go, you know, very, very, very low. Those schools have some interesting infrastructure challenges. If you go really low, you know, electricity becomes a problem. And we actually decided can't solve that. You know, hand cranks are a great alternative, but in reality, if you're going to really think about solutions for schools where electricity is a problem, maybe technology isn't the first thing you should be spending your money on. And, you know, there are other, you know, things like roads and food and, you know, meals and things like that that are, you know, probably more important to actually tackle. So by kind of leaving off electricity, you know, for one thing, it actually leaves off a large chunk of rural schools. So you now are looking at more at peri-urban schools and schools with other infrastructure that's there. Still incredibly poor because, you know, slums are a reality, but a different profile of school. But on the top end of it, you know, like where is that line between, you know, in schools, we realize that while many schools have internet connectivity, it's not necessarily high bandwidth, reliable, always connected internet connectivity. At least it's not internet connectivity where you can design a hosted solution for. You've got to think about, you know, disconnected and local. So the thin client thing is really interesting because, yes, that's exactly what we're proposing, but we're proposing that what it's connecting to is a server in that school. That connecting to a cloud is not necessarily feasible. You can connect to the cloud occasionally, but not all the time, and certainly not in a way that you could actually run your classroom based on, you know, expecting it to be there.
Sure. And if, you know, and the server could actually connect to the cloud.
Absolutely. Or to the regional you know, area or something of that sort. And, you know, depending on the solution, it could connect maybe even just once a quarter. It doesn't necessarily have to connect all the time. And in a worst-case scenario, to scale down, you could even think about Sneakernet as your potential, you know, updatability. It doesn't always have to be the way we think about, you know, the rest of our solutions. And, of course, by designing it that way, you now have a solution for a government that kind of spans. Here's a solution for a school that looks like this. And, you know, it'll grow with you. If you can connect to the internet all the time, hey, you know, here are all these other things that you can do as well. But, you know, just a spectrum kind of along that curve. And we thought that was an important design point to think about.
Cool.
Wow. So tell us a little bit about your story. What's your background? How long have you been doing this?
So my background, I guess I'll divide that up into kind of three parts.
Okay.
Architect.
Yeah. You must look at Microsoft.
And then I'll calculate whether or not we're going down this path.
I started off at Merck & Company right out of college. It's a pharmaceutical company on the East Coast. And there I worked on two different kinds of things. I worked on Salesforce automation, so just making sure that pharmaceutical sales reps were able to maximize their visits with doctors in order to increase our sales. And then I also worked on financial data warehousing for them. I worked there for 5 years and then joined Microsoft in, I guess it was January of 1997, initially to work on data warehousing and MSN, but I, like most Microsoft employees, was reorged on my first day of work and actually ended up on the advertising system instead. It was a long time ago, so things have certainly changed since I was there, and I will jokingly refer to myself as the Vice President of Program Management, but in fact, I was the only PM, so it was a different time altogether. And we had scale challenges, which will sound silly today, because, you know, we thought we were going from 2 million ads per day to, oh, it'll never get beyond 10 million ads per day. Surely that's the, you know, the limit of what we have to actually design for. And, of course, it's probably closer to 2 billion ads per day now, so it's, you know, entirely ridiculous. But at that time, revenue was $18 million a year. The next year was $54 million a year. The next year was $200 million a year. And so it was a great time to be there because, you know, we were all, you know, learning it as it was happening. And it was, we were clearly onto something and yet didn't have all the answers. I also worked then on the data warehousing problem, helped Tarek Najam release the first version of IDSS, Because what we realized in the advertising problem is that the hard problem was certainly, you know, rotating the banners and having the right targeted ad is a hard problem. I'm not trying to trivialize it. But in that time, the harder problem or the more important problem for the business was the reporting back to the advertiser on what happened. Mm-hmm. We were still trying to convince people to move from TV to the internet. You know, it wasn't, you know, the medium itself had not been proved yet. And of course, it has been today. But at that time, that was a bigger deal. So, you know, trying to figure out the reporting problem was really important, so I wanted to move on that. And then we realized, well, the reporting is, you know, a hard problem, there is no doubt, but a lot of trying to capture the right reports means that the data has to be tagged appropriately in the first place before you can actually, you know, parse through all that collected data and get some interesting analytics. And so I moved on then to the content management system. It was really all the same problem, just different aspects of it. And it was kind of a normal path of PM, Lead PM, GPM, and then PAMO, the content management system. After 6.5 years in MSN, I moved to Windows Client. It was a fairly deliberate move. While everybody else was moving from client to services, since services was all I had done at that point, I realized, you know, I really need to understand where does the money come from, and what is this, you know, kind of the mainstay of the Microsoft business, and I really wanted to get my hands on that. When I joined at Milestone 5 of Longhorn, which, of course, everyone told me we were almost done, and it turned out to be just the beginning, and that was great. I started off on the mobile PC group and then actually became the product unit manager for tablet PC, and it was a great time. We had some very specific things that we wanted to accomplish for tablet at that time. The number one thing was increasing the number of OEMs that were participating in the tablet ecosystem. Getting Dell was an important metric, and we did accomplish that, and every manufacturer since has released more versions of tablet. Mm. I'm also happy to say that when Vista shipped, with, you know, tablet PC hardware was the one consistent hardware that always shipped Vista. Nobody hedged their bets and shipped XP and Vista. It was, you know, Vista 100%, because the features for tablet were just so much better than its predecessor that it was, you know, worth the early adoption, you know, right away. Yeah. But it was unfinished business for me when we shipped tablet that because, you know, it's easy as soon as you start writing at all, you know, digitally writing, that the great place where this could be used would be education. And yet one of the funny, you know, things that happen when you try and make tablets as broad as possible is that the cheapest tablet on the market would inherently be the biggest because it would have desktop components and, you know, it would be fairly cheaper. And that's exactly the hardware that doesn't work in education. So it was one of those unfinished business problems that while the software and the scenario, if you will, from a UX perspective was perfect for educational scenarios, actually the hardware wasn't, you know, all the way through. Now, despite that, you know, tablets had tremendous success in education, but it was a niggling, annoying thing. So I started chewing on some ideas for, you know, education and for you know, applying tablet technology in that area, and started incubating a project called Milpa that takes advantage of a lot of what we did in Vista and tablet, but then puts it in a completely different business model, and that led me down a path of designing that product and then working on other educational scenarios, and here I am.
Interesting.
Wow. That is quite a diverse background.
Absolutely. That's amazing. So right now, do you want to go back into the product kind of world, or do you want to stick in the unlimited potential group?
Well, the unlimited potential group is, you know, both a product group as well as a umbrella organization that captures, you know, what Microsoft across the company does for these markets. But as a product group, it is much more of an incubation group than it is, I'd say, strictly a product group. You know, we tend to take things that are absolutely nation and that would probably not make the cut list if it started off in a larger business group. Mm-hmm. And then because we know that emerging markets has potential, we want to, you know, kind of see where it goes. But then if successful, it kind of moves on. Mm-hmm. So our the two education products that I've worked on here have actually what we would say graduated to the education product group to go on to become other things. So as far as, you know, what to do next, we're cooking up more stuff. You know, it is kind of fun to work on the incubation side of things. And will I ever want to move back to the more developed product group side? Absolutely. You know, it's a long career. There's lots of time, and it's, I think, good to do different rounds in different places to get different perspectives. Mm-hmm. It's good to have that, you know, shipping experience of very, very mature products because it helps you design incubations a heck of a lot better when you have some innate understanding of what the long-term maintenance issues are going to be for particular paths. And the experience that you get in thinking about incubations or any kind of emerging market is, I think, absolutely essential to doing a better job in a product group, because you've kind of internalized and honed what an essential value proposition has to be and how to really differentiate what your product is from the alternatives. And in emerging markets especially, you learn to differentiate not just against other technology projects, potentially against other things in general. You know, a new consumer in an emerging market has the option to spend their, you know, say, consumer discretionary income on, you know, brand new label clothes or technology from us. It's not just, it's just not a shift within a technology mix. And so you've really got to know what your value proposition is and make that, you know, unbelievably clear so it can kind of filter through and connect.
That's true. So now, did you tell us where you, what did you study in school? I mean, how did you get into this madness?
How did I get into this madness? Well, I'm of Indian origin, which meant I had only two choices. It was electrical engineering or medicine. And
is that really the case?
That's what we heard from another Indian woman. But no, another Indian woman made the same joke.
Interesting. So it's not a joke. It's not really a joke.
So the rebellion was to not go into electrical engineering and go into computer science.
Because
Ooh. Exactly. I was going to make everyone mad. Yeah. So,
interesting.
Yeah. So, you know, that's kind of how you fall into it. It's, you know, it was a hobby in high school, but certainly, you know, parental influence was there to go towards technical fields. And, you know, I'm a first-generation immigrant, and so like many immigrants who come to this country, they tend to be relatively technical, and my parents were too, and so there's some degree of just, you know, household influence, if you will. So that's, I'd say, how it got started. Although I can also say, very honestly, I think the spark of real interest in computer science, beyond kind of the tinkering, it was kind of cool, and, you know, let me see what I can create. I'd say the real interest really got started when I did do my first internship at Merck, because now I could see, you know, all the dots connected. This is not just some interesting exercise of, you know, what are the cool things I can do on my own personal screen, but we could use technology to really move businesses that really moved, you know, how, you know, people's lives could be potentially saved. I mean, the implications were really tremendous when you start thinking about the absolute multiplier effects and thinking about technology, you know, off the, off your own kind of the personal high of creating something, and, you know, I'd say the greater high of thinking about things in terms of the solutions and what those implications were going to be. So, you know, the job experience at Merck was absolutely, absolutely influential in my interest, and it led to my getting an MBA in finance while I was working at Merck, not because I had any intention of joining the financial industry, but since I was working on financial data warehousing solutions, I really wanted to understand that problem as well as I could, because that would help me, you know, design better software to solve that problem.
Sure.
And in general, I have always been very motivated by, you know, what is the business problem that we're trying to solve for ourselves, for our customers, for the customers that those customers are trying to connect with, and kind of down that chain, because technology can do a lot of stuff, and so picking the right stuff is, you know, just as critical as doing it well if you want to have the impact.
Absolutely. I mean, you could argue that, and this is not bashing Microsoft, Ritzy.
Okay.
But you could argue that we are an incredible company at creating complex and really interesting innovative technology, but not necessarily how we end up putting it together and shipping it out. I mean, that's kind of a controversial thing to say. It may not be coming out as I kind of mean it, but we can develop incredible solutions, right? Incredible technologies in and of itself. Sometimes the way that we put those technologies together sort of lead one to question, you know, what is that? Why did we do it that way? What are we doing?
Well, it's a fine topic to bring up. The thing that becomes interesting to consider is, you know, when should we be the company that figures out that solution kind of end-to-end, and when do we have to leave that for partners to do? Mm-hmm. And there's no right answer to that question. We will get criticisms for not leaving enough for partners to do, to, you know, keep the ecosystem vibrant and healthy, and at the same point we'll get criticisms for not having shown kind of the absolute best integration kind of across that line. Certainly from the Talib PC perspective, I'd say, you know, we got both those criticisms and both of them were warranted. So I know it's, that's why I say it's a hard and controversial thing. By being part of the operating system, you know, you're, the tack you're taking is that ISVs and the solution builders and solutions providers and OEMs who are in the process of selling you a solution, you know, will kind of stitch all those things together. But then by not having the one, you know, excellent example up and down the chain, you know, did we not inspire our ecosystem to effectively take advantage of all the stuff that we had offered? You know, I have lots of things that I'm extremely proud of in Talib PC, but certainly a personal regret was that some of the features that we have in the operating system were not discoverable for our ecosystem or our customers to find. And had we considered building solutions, you know, end-to-end, it would have demonstrated that. So it was that kind of, I'd say, personal angst that led me down building peripheral products like this one that is a paper-based digitizer as opposed to a kind of Wacom external digitizer over here, where you actually, you know, write on paper and it captures your ink. Unfortunately, this particular device has lost its charge or it would have made a great demo. Clearly, I was not prepared. But it, you know, it captures your ink on paper. People really do like, you know, working on paper. But this has a CE screen. Let's see if there's any charge at all. Yeah, this has a CE screen. So if you're going to be, say, watching a video, this happens to be on sailing because we have an avid sailor on our team. You can take notes about this. And it'll sync up with that so that when you come back to your PC, it's as if you took it right while we were there, but now you've got this device that you can take with you that isn't nearly as costly as having a PC on your own that's mobile. So you can consider now shared access solutions where maybe people are using internet cafes or school labs for the bulk of their PC computing, but then have something to take with them to learn and, you know, kind of go forward. You know, so what we've done in the emerging markets context is actually think about a solution absolutely end-to-end, so from a peripheral device to a client solution to services, all based on our platform. But the reason why we did it in an emerging market context was that there was no partner that was apparent that was in a position to do such a thing. And so it makes sense for the business to do that here. It may not make sense for the business to do that everywhere. And it's a very funny line on what that is. And I'm not sure how you discover that line except trying it both ways, seeing what's working and then trying it again. I don't know that there's a divining rod per se. But in the emerging markets context, I'm more confident that we're making the right choice and thinking about it absolutely end to end and having the scenario that, that connects.
That's cool.
Wow.
We'll see.
That's really interesting. So I would imagine that since you're an architect, you're in a lot of meetings where you're, you know, again, this is the women episode. So what we're trying to do is focus on women in technology. That's why we created the show, because we're interested. Like, what are women doing at Microsoft? Because when you look at the sort of the canonical examples of, you know, our IQ and our innovators, it's all dudes. It's all men across the board. At least at the very senior levels, right? There are no female technical fellows.
Dudes.
So, sorry. I also call it... I'm also
going to say, it's kind of genderless. So
sorry. Interesting. But how about knuckle draggers? I'm a knuckle dragger.
Right,
but I mean, the
enough.
Point is...
Yeah, there's no way to discount or to deny those statistics. It's a fairly male-dominated field, certainly at senior levels.
Exactly. So that's what we wanted to address. Like, what are the women that... Because there are lots of women at Microsoft.
There
what
are
they doing? So that's why... So the reason I said that was I wanted to segue into a question particularly about you being a senior sort of technical person as an architect. What are your... How many other women do you engage in and have these conversations about trying to solve problems in your... In your context?
In your peer group?
In my peer group, who do I interact with that's female? That's a... This is a, there's got to be like a bunch of them.
What?
Who do I talk with? You know, for this particular space, the peer group folks that I'm working with are not necessarily technical, who are the women that I interact with. I do interact with a lot of business folks because we are in emerging markets, and so we're trying to figure out a whole new licensing models, business models, and operations models that you know, I've now started to learn the lingo, but I couldn't consider myself an expert on. I know enough to be dangerous, but that's about it. We have a lot of very senior, talented women in a lot of those fields, certainly in public sector and in operations and a whole bunch of different places. But you're right, from a technical perspective, I'm actually struggling, and I'm embarrassed to say that I'm struggling to come up with a great example of somebody else who is a peer technical person that I've been working with closely recently.
Well, did you ever think about the fact that you were in the minority as a woman, like in school, in classes, or in a meeting where you may be the only female?
It's impossible to ignore or to not notice because, yeah, there's, you know, there's no one, it's hard to find people like you. So that's not to say that there aren't other senior technical women in the company. I know them because we network and you know, we know each other. I just haven't been interacting with any of them, you know, in the last, say, couple of years, you know, during this particular episode of what we've been trying to create here. But absolutely, it comes up, and you know, there are things that you develop as styles and as methods and as ways that help you retain your identity and also fit in, because fitting in is important if you want to be able to work across large groups. Trust is an essential part of that occurring, and so people have to feel like they can identify with you. And if when you are so much different than everyone else, you have to take a little bit more effort to kind of explain what the bridge is and make it a non-issue, so that you know the rest of the collaboration can occur. You know, on the other hand, you know, certainly I take pride in you know being where I am and what I've been able to accomplish so far, but. You know, I'm not a pioneer. You know, my mother was a technical person in industry for a long time, so I've had phenomenally great role model, you know, very, very close to home of not only is it possible, achievable, but desirable, and actually your, you know, God-given duty, if you will, to explore to your fullest potential and, you know, make sure something happens. But, you know, I can say during a career, and it's been a long one now that we've recapped the entire thing, can say that I'm old. Over a career, you know, there are kind of different stages.
That's another series.
How the older faring. So there are certainly, you know, there are different coping mechanisms or strategies that I'd say are different throughout different times in your career. I was, when I was more junior in my career, I think I was a little bit more tepid. I mean, there was a little bit less confidence in what my long-term impact was going to be, and so I think I was, you know, I was a different person than, you know, what ended up getting shaped. Coming to Microsoft, ironically, even though far more male-dominated than Merck as a contrast, has made me a much better employee from that standpoint than Merck was probably going to, because here you have to, you know, there is that, you know, sink or swim kind of, you know, culture, which was great for me. It's not great for a lot of other women, but for me it was great because, you know, I learned to swim. I remember my first spec review as a program manager at Microsoft, you know, as if it was yesterday. I was used to a very, you know, blue chip East Coast culture where people were polite. and if they didn't agree with you in a meeting, they would, you know, take it up with you outside of the meeting. You know, there was just it's not that people weren't direct, it was just a very different corporate culture. You know, a 100-year-old East Coast company is just going to be different that way. And that first spec review that I had here, I was absolutely not prepared for the, you know, the cutting down of everything that I had, like every paragraph, every sentence, it was just like, it was constant, you know, and after that meeting was done, I ran to the ladies' room and I cried. Yeah, I was just devastated. Just, I can't even begin to describe the emotional devastation. And so then we come down to the second spec review, and don't you know, it kind of happens again. So right, the third time, I'm not letting this happen. So you become a lot more adept at, okay, well, so who are all the people I need to get to before this meeting? And how do I make sure that I really am addressing all these things? And how do I make sure I've got it buttoned up and I really know what the answers are and how can I anticipate what the questions are and what the read questions are going to be? And, you know, I'm going to know it backwards and forwards and backwards and forwards, and that is just never going to happen to me again. It made me better. You know, it absolutely made me better. So, you know, was I personally more devastated because I was a minority in the room? Probably, because, you know, it's so easy to take it personally. Was it meant personally? You know, probably not. But, you know, what to do? You know, you feel how you feel. And so it became a great forcing function to figure out how to be, you know, tough about things without really, you know, losing who I am. But it also gives you lots of reason to think about who you really are, which is a gift. it's an absolute gift, you know. If anytime you have an opportunity to really think about what you believe in, take it.
Hmm. And just for the record, there have been lots of men that have gone through that same spec review process that have done their own form of crying in the ladies' room.
Exactly.
Microsoft breaks everyone down equally, okay?
Absolutely.
That's true. And that's what I love about this company.
Indeed.
So,
fierce.
So what does the future hold for you?
That's a great question. You know, I'm certainly it's the review time of the year, and so you can't help but wonder. You know, I hope for a long career with the company.
How long has it been?
12 years now. And, you know, I've found, and I don't know that this has been a plan, but certainly I've found that every 6 or 7 years I tend to want to go do something, you know, completely new, either a completely different domain or, you know, a completely different something. And I find that I do that because, you know, while you can be effective in a job, you know, and earn your salary within 3 to 4 months of showing up, you don't really know an area until you've been there for, you know, a couple of years to some extent. You know, in a year, you're kind of an expert. In 2 years, you know, you don't even have to, you know, people will assume you're the expert.
Right.
And, you know, hopefully you've earned that. And it takes almost that long before you have kind of, I'd say, that critical insight of, you know, if the technology could just move this way, wow, all sorts of things can, you know, really, really open up. And that just, it just takes time and place. Mm-hmm. But because I've had a fairly diverse career, and I've had influences from IT and from other industries, as well as from services and MSN, and now from Windows Client and from Tablet, I'd like to think that I have a lot of things to pull from for that essential insight of, you know, in a new domain, that it may not be, no ideas are brand new ideas, but what is new is kind of the reapplication of something from one place into something completely different where, you know, fantastic things can happen. And then, frankly, it takes 3 or 4 years to implement that because there are other cycles in that product's course that you have to work around. So if you want this thing to happen, well, first you got to move this here, move that there, and, you know, and be determined about that and not let, you know, reorgs or other, you know, influential things mess up that trajectory. It might take longer, but you shouldn't, you know, kind of take it off track. So it takes 6 or 7 years. So I guess in some ways I'm looking for what is that next 6 or 7 year thing. I don't know what that'll be, and then hopefully there'll be another 6 and 7 year thing and another one after that. I don't know that I've got a plan beyond that, except I certainly enjoy the continuous challenge.
Excellent.
That's great.
Very cool.
What do you think, Carmine?
I think this has been fantastic.
I think it's nice to find a technical woman that articulates so well and has so many diverse stories to tell.
Absolutely.
Yeah. We've been, we love this show, but finding the more technical women has been a challenge.
Fair enough. So if there's it's something that we could all work on together.
Yes, exactly.
Excellent.
Thank you.
Cool. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Here.